internet. My name is Gary, and welcome to the All Have a Beer and Talk podcast, a shadowy flight into the dangerous world of a man who does not exist. Wait, that's the wrong copy. Hang on. All right, let's try this again. All Have a Beer and Talk, a shadowy flight into the dangerous world of a man who likes to talk about technology news stories while he enjoys a random craft beer weekly. That's better. Hope you're having a great 2018, keeping happy and sane and enjoying yourselves. My wife and I renewed our membership at the local zoo and spent some time interacting with lions, elephants, and penguins, among other animals. If you're the type of person who likes to search Instagram for I'll Have a Beer and Talk, you may see a photo of me with a beer interacting with some penguins. I lead a rich life. And to complement that, I need a rich beer. Randomizer, would you please select a random beer for... you've already started. All right, the randomizer has made its random selection from the beer cellars of the All Have a Beer and Talk bunker, and this week I have Odell Brewing Company's Freak, that's F-R-I-E-K, a 6.5% ABV oak barrel aged American wild ale with cherries and raspberries added. Yum yum. Wild ales are beers that are introduced to wild, but safe, bacteria and yeasties. BeerAdvocate.com notes that those wild critters in wild ales, quote, often leave a funky calling card that can be quite strange, interesting, pleasing to many, but also often deemed as undesirable by many. Sounds a lot like me. I like me, so I think I'll like this. Beer Mike, engage. Sorry, I should have warned you that this bottle was had a cork in it. It smells wonderful, like a fantastic lambic, very, very fruity bouquet. It is a kind of a red-brown color, very beautiful color as well, with a white head, very tiny, not very heady. Let's see if it's pleasing or undesirable. Oh, that is beautiful, like a raspberry soda. It's very, very tart and crisp, effervescent. A very, very drinkable beer. Perfect for a Monday night. I'm sure at this point in the 21st century, you've heard of the blockchain. You know, that thing that's intertwined with Bitcoin and digital cryptocurrencies? Huh? I'm judging from your assumed silence that you don't know what the hell I'm talking about. Okay, I will try to quickly explain what the blockchain is. Full disclosure, I barely understand what it is myself, and I had to look it up. And I found a great article on Medium by Colin Thompson, so I'm cribbing from that. A blockchain is a type of distributed and decentralized ledger or database, one that has a continuously updated digital record of who owns what. When a digital transaction occurs, it is grouped into a cryptographically protected block of similar digital transactions that have occurred in the last 10 minutes, which is then sent out to the blockchain network. From there, members of the network with powerful computers compete to solve complex coded problems to validate the block. The first miner to validate the block receives a reward. For example, if they are working on the Bitcoin blockchain network, they get Bitcoins. And the block of validated transactions is timestamped and added to the chain of validated blocks, all in linear chronological order. New blocks are linked to older blocks, creating the chain that shows every transaction, all the way back to the first block of that particular blockchain. Because the chain is continually updated, every member on the network knows and can prove who owns what at any time. Clear? Clear as mud? Don't feel embarrassed. Anyway, there's been some funny stories about companies that have very little to do with the blockchain suddenly saying they're doing something with the blockchain, and they see their stock value increase. I read about this particular company on Gizmodo, but let me give you some examples. Longfin, a financial technology company, bought a worthless cryptocurrency company last month, and its stock inexplicably went straight up by 2,000%. Iced tea maker Long Island Iced Tea changed its name to Long Blockchain and saw its stock triple. I don't know what iced tea has to do with cryptocurrency, but it now totally does have something to do with it. Chanticleer Holdings, a company that owns several restaurant chains and incidentally bought the rights to Portland's Little Big Burger chain back in 2015, announced that it would be utilizing the blockchain to keep their restaurant's loyalty program secure. We wanted to expand our existing loyalty program with something that really changes the way our customers can leverage their rewards. Movivity Merit is real cryptocurrency, leveraging the same infrastructure and principles of Bitcoin, Ethereum, Ripple, Litecoin, and more, and will enable our customers to make use of their rewards in entirely new ways, said Michael Pruitt, CEO of Chanticleer Holdings, in a press release. Okay. Basically, they're making the points obtained from the loyalty programs of their various restaurant properties valid for any of their other restaurant properties. Gizmodo points out that there is no real reason why the loyalty programs need to be tracked in a blockchain, but the stock value of Chanticleer Holdings, which trades under the funny name BURG, Berg, Burger, get it, went up by 50% after the blockchain announcement and closed out the day at 40% above its starting point. So even if it all means nothing, it made money. Oh, and did I mention Chanticleer Holdings owns 9 Hooters restaurants? You know what that means. Blockchain and boobs. Were you aware that your body contains an ecosystem of fungi and bacteria called the microbiome? It's true. And the microbiome is present in all mammals. Medical research has found over and over again that the microbes in your own personal microbiome affect everything going on inside you, from infections to digestion to even birth if you're female. It is possible to send special microbes into your ecosystem to deliver medicine to specific areas, but in order to do that successfully, you'd need to know where those special microbes are. The Verge reports that a new study published in the journal Nature details the success scientists have had in engineering a special microbe that can be tracked via ultrasound. Ultrasound is used when trying to image the innards of our squishy human bodies. Traditional imaging techniques use light, but our human tissues are pretty opaque, especially the deeper you want to look. Ultrasound works by sending sound waves into the body and listening to the echoes that come back. The echoes differ based on how dense the tissue is that the sound went through, and by analyzing the different echo patterns, one can determine where something is. Some bacteria contain what's called gas vesicles, which are hollow internal structures. When hit with ultrasound, these vesicles scatter sound waves in a particular way, making them relatively easy to locate and track. The study detailed how scientists added gas vesicles to cells that don't have these structures normally. They engineered specific bacteria to have the vesicles and injected them into a mouse gut and a mouse tumor. By utilizing ultrasound, they were able to successfully track the engineered bacteria as they scooted around inside the gut and the tumor. The promise of this study is that this technique can be refined for use in monitoring drug delivery in cancer patients. So bacteria can now report back on their whereabouts thanks to gas vesicles! Post-traumatic stress disorder is a horrible, horrible beast. Conventional methods for dealing with PTSD, such as antidepressants or psychotherapy, aren't always effective in helping those who suffer from it, and it can end up being debilitating. Digital Trends reports that a new technique is showing promise, and it involves letting the patient just listen to themselves. Specifically, they listen to their own brainwaves, using a system called Hyrem. That's H-I-R-R-E-M. Hyrem, according to Dr. Charles Tegler, who goes by Chuck, stands for High Resolution Relational Resonance-Based Electroencephalic Mirroring, and is, quote, closed-loop brainwave mirroring acoustic simulation neurotechnology. Chuck went on to tell Digital Trends that software algorithms process electrical information collected by scalp sensors, and in real time translate specific brain frequencies into audible tones of varying pitch. While the participant relaxes in a zero-gravity chair, oh, that sounds nice, the tones are reflected back via earbuds bilaterally, simultaneously, in as little as 8 milliseconds. The process requires no conscious, cognitive activity, so it still has effect even if the participant falls asleep during an eyes-closed protocol or reads a book during an eyes-open protocol. Wow. Hyrem technology was created by the appropriately named company Brain State Technologies in Scottsdale, Arizona, and the Wake Forest School of Medicine in Winston-Salem, North Carolina has been conducting research with the technology in various neurological and neuropsychological situations since 2011. The basic idea behind having people listen to their own brainwaves is that it makes them aware of the connection between their brain pattern and sound. Hearing immediate feedback in the pattern based on what they're doing can allow them to learn how to self-correct behaviors to keep the pattern calm. Having enrolled over 480 participants into one of five clinical studies, we have observed that the use of Hyrum is associated with reduced self-reported symptoms such as insomnia, depression, stress, and anxiety, Chuck said. Many report a sense of greater calm, reduced irritability, and improved focus and concentration. We have also noted improvement of autonomic cardiovascular regulation as analyzed by objective measures of heart rate variability and baroreflex sensitivity. The team at the Wake Forest School recently published a paper on their work in dealing with PTSD in the journal Military Medical Research and hope one day they can seek FDA approval to use Hyrum for PTSD treatment. I'm really excited about this technology, a drugless way to alleviate the pain and damage all those nasty mind critters do. Plus, it could create some pretty awesome ambient music. Win-win. I know of another drug-free way of alleviating stress and anxiety that works for me, and maybe it could work for you too. It involves water, pulp, a vat, a mold, and a decal. You guessed it, I'm talking about making paper by hand, because this show's sponsor is Portland's only community handmade papermaking studio, Pulp and Decal. Pulp and Decal's mission is to keep the art of papermaking alive with workshops, demonstrations, creating and selling beautiful handmade paper products, and working with artists in creating all styles of art through the medium of papermaking. Browse a rotating selection of papermaking workshops, inquire about custom orders, take an online recycled papermaking class, and check out all the amazing things we do with the ancient art of papermaking by visiting pulpanddecal.com. That is pulpanddecale.com. Mention I'll have a beer and talk and we might give you something special. You know how you can kind of tell if someone is sick just by looking at them? Well, guess what? Research shows that your assessment of someone's health just from the look on their face is actually pretty accurate, according to a study published in the ostentatious-sounding Proceedings of the Royal Society B, reports Gizmodo. Very little research has actually been done to determine if we humans can visually sense illness in others, which is surprising, since we have so many idioms about being able to do exactly that, like someone looking green around the gills or paler than death. To get started, the researchers collected some information from a previous study they had performed, involving getting people sick to see if they would make riskier choices about money. And in case you're wondering, the results of that study indicated that yes, people do make riskier money choices when they're sick. Anyway, in that study, 21 volunteers were injected with either a placebo saline solution or a non-contagious endotoxin derived from a strain of E. coli that would make them slightly sick, but with no lasting side effects. 3 to 4 weeks after that, the injections were swapped. Each volunteer that got the placebo got the E. coli, and vice versa. And all the volunteers had their photos taken 2 hours after the injections. Using these photos as great examples of the same person being both sick and healthy, the researchers chose photos of 16 of those volunteers from the previous study to show to people in the new study, with a slight morphing applied to the photos to make them look as average as possible. The photos were then shown in a random order to 62 volunteers, 5 seconds at a time, and the volunteers were tasked with identifying if the person in the photograph looked sick or healthy. They were able to tell, with a success rate better than chance, if the person in the photo was sick with at least 13 of the 16 people presented to them. 2/3 of the sick guesses were correct. In a second session, 60 volunteers were asked if there were specific facial markers associated with sickness present on the people they felt were sick, and to rank them. The highest ranked cues were paler lip skin, droopier corners of the mouth, and a puffy face. So watch out for those people. Our findings suggest that facial cues associated with the skin, mouth, and eyes can aid in the detection of acutely sick and potentially contagious people, the researchers noted. This is pretty remarkable because it shows that humans have an ability to recognize a just barely sick person in a crowd based on very subtle facial cues, and that can turn out to be incredibly useful in treating illness. Doctors can take a look at your face during a standard checkup and determine if maybe you should go get some more rest and a decongestant to deal with an oncoming cold. Or to just get that dang flu shot already. That's a note to myself. Here at the bunker and the grounds above, we've encountered a first world problem which you may or may not be familiar with. Like most places, the internet comes down from a coaxial cable into a modem, then out from the modem into a Wi-Fi router. That little router tries its hardest, but it can't quite extend its information-laden wireless goodness everywhere it needs to on the surface and underground locations here for all of our internet needs. I've tried to rectify this in an ad hoc way. I have an Ethernet cable going under the service to an Ethernet switch in the bunker, and then a line from that is connected to a wireless access point, and I have another line going into an Ethernet over power line adapter to carry the internet over electrical lines to a matching adapter in the Pulp and Deckel studio, which is connected to another wireless access point, which attempts to spread wireless access to the grounds of our complex. It's not a great system, but it works about 75% of the time. If I was a man of means, I'd get one of those fancy home Wi-Fi mesh network solutions. Those are sets of wireless routers, usually in groups of three, designed to speak to each other so that they can optimize the wireless bandwidth across the distances between them. Several of these easy mesh network device packs have popped up recently in the retail space, like the Eero, or Google Wi-Fi, or Netgear's Orbi, but to get started with those, you have to lay out a minimum of $300. I'm not a beggar, but I'm also not flush with that kind of cash at any given moment. But not only that cost, you basically have to replace your perfectly fine Wi-Fi router with these systems. It is possible to roll your own mesh, like I have, but it's not really that reliable. Too many moving parts. ASUS knows your and my pain, and I read about on both Engadget and Gizmodo that ASUS has recently announced AI Mesh, a software update that turns older ASUS routers into access points in a mesh network. Install the AI Mesh software on at least two routers, and huzzah, you've got a mesh network. ASUS published a list of compatible ASUS routers, the least expensive of which runs about $40 to $70, depending how much effort you want to put into the hunt. So for half the cost of an out-of-the-box mesh setup, you can grab some routers and build out your mesh network as you see fit. Freedom and repurposing. America! Interactivity time. Say you're at the grocer and just have the staples to buy. Coffee, beer, and some just random solid food items. The line you're in is barely moving, and there's another line or two that you can see that have fewer people queued up. There's no one behind you in line. What do you do? If you chose to jump in another line, you have chosen poorly. And will more often than not end up waiting in the new line longer. My first daily blog obsession, Lifehacker, posted about researchers at Harvard Business School making this shocking discovery. If you're the last person in a line, you're more likely to make decisions that can backfire. If you're in a line with no one behind you, you are four times more likely to think another line will move faster, but making that choice equates to waiting longer than you would have if you had just stayed put. It stems from no one wanting to feel like they're last. Somehow, people's perception of waiting in line is predicated on if there are a number of people waiting behind you, even though that has nothing to do with the wait, and that perception overrides other observable parameters that actually do have an effect on the wait. Sure, that other line may have less people in it, but they all have more items than everyone in front of you do, so your line will still move faster. So if you get impatient, stay in the queue. The odds are better that you'll get out of there faster, and respecting the queue is the proper British thing to do anyway. For the closing animal story this week, Boing Boing gave me the perfect article, which talks about hagfish slime and a robotic shark mouth. Hagfish are widely regarded as the most disgusting creature on Earth. Well, probably the most disgusting creature on Earth not holding public office, because of their famed slime. They have 100 glands all over their body that excrete a super sticky slime after they perceive an attack, designed through evolution to clog the gills of the would-be predator, allowing the hagfish to slip away. This biological grossness defense has been so effective in making the hagfish unpalatable to predators, the hagfish hasn't felt a need to evolve further in any significant way for almost 300 million years. Evidently, Mako sharks did not get the memo, and they still try to eat those slimy hagfish. This brought up a mystery for scientists. How do the hagfish survive the first strike bite of a shark? They only release the slime after being attacked. How strong is hagfish skin anyway? Questions for the ages. According to popular science, biologists at several universities got together to figure out what the deal is with hagfish surviving shark bites, and did the most reasonable thing to do some tests. To accurately simulate the speed and force of a shark bite, they built a spring-loaded shark tooth guillotine. This amazing product of modern science was used to chomp down on dead hagfish to determine if they have shark tooth impervious skin or if something else was going on. Unsurprisingly, the shark teeth easily penetrated the skin of the hagfish, so sadly we will not be able to create hagfish armor plating for shark dives. So how do those hagfish survive the bite then? Turns out the bites only penetrate the skin and not the muscle underneath. The skin is so loose on the hagfish that the muscle slides away. Skin is easier to heal than muscle, so the hagfish survive because they only suffer flesh wounds when encountering hungry, hungry makos, and the slime defense prevents a second attack. So maybe we could make some hagfish armor for shark dives, but instead of just being real tough, it could preemptively eject goo when sensing an imminent attack. Patenting idea now. Hello, everyone. Let's get funky. Deep, deep dive. This show is not only supported by Pulp and Deckel, it's supported by listeners just like you. You're just like you, right? If you get value or entertainment from this show, maybe you too would like to support me. You can always hire me for some voice and audio production work. I can do voicemail messages, mediocre acting, bad singing, and some adequate audio production. I started editing the Paper Talk podcast. You should go check that one out. If you feel you or someone you know might have a use for the best part of my body, which happens to be my voice and my brain, let me know. Email me at gary@pulpandeckel.com. That is G-A-R-Y at P-U-L-P-A-N-D-D-E-C-K-L-E.com. Rates are reasonable. And if you could be so kind to rate and review the show on iTunes, the more I have ass discoverability will go up for people looking for beery tech podcasts on iTunes. And you can also support the show directly with money. If you enjoy my show each week, you can donate at least $1 a month to the show. You can do that at patreon.com/iHaveBadRadio. That is patreon.com/IHABATRADIO. Go to patreon.com/iHaveItRadio and become my patron. You'll be joining a very attractive and intelligent group that already support me there. I couldn't do it without you. I have finished the freak, and it's super freaky. Although, wait, stop the press. I gave you the wrong ABV for this beer. It is actually 6.9% alcohol by volume. Yippee! But alas, it's time for me to go. Please tell your family, friends, neighbors, pets, plants, aliens, and Diabolik about the show, and that they can find it on Google Play Music, on iTunes, on Podomatic, on Stitcher, and on Spreaker. And please send me feedback, story suggestions, and beer recommendations to gary@pulpandeckel.com, or on the Twitters and Instagram at iHaveItRadio, or even on the Facebook at facebook.com/iHaveItRadio. It's time for me to go. I will see you in the future. Bye-bye!